all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
Welcome to Veterans Radio. I am Jim Fossone. I'm the officer of the deck today. The program today is going to focus on Afghanistan as we approach the two-year withdrawal from Afghanistan after the 20-year war that so many of our veterans participated in now. So we're going to bring you programs about being in a remote outpost in Afghanistan. We're talking to Travis Harmon, who was part of the Pennsylvania National Guard and spent time fighting with the U.S. Army in Afghanistan. And then we're going to talk to Michael Cook, who wrote about the life and death at Abbey Gate, really talking about the struggles of people trying to get out of Afghanistan, Afghan nationals, as Abbey Gate exploded and life exploded there in Afghanistan. We've talked about this issue a little bit in the past. Back in September of 22, we talked to Major Tom Schuman, who wrote a fantastic book called Always Faithful, worth listening to that podcast. And we've written stories on this for Home of Heroes. If you go to homeofheroes.com, go to the War on Terror stories, read Air Heroes of Afghanistan Invasion. Some pilots and flight nurses received the Distinguished Flying Cross. Or go read the story of Sergeant Julie Brigolo, who was an air medic, again, received the Distinguished Flying Cross. So some incredible stories comes out of service in Afghanistan, and we're going to talk about these stories today. We always want to remind you, you can find more about Veterans Radio at its Facebook site or at the web. VeteransRadio.org is our new URL, VeteransRadio.org. Where we're on the web 24/7. You can find a lot of our podcasts there as well. We post new ones every Tuesday. And before we get started, we want to thank our sponsors. First up, we want to thank National Veteran Business Development Council, NVBDC.org. It was established to certify both service-disabled and veteran-owned businesses. You'll find out how they can help your business by going to nvbdc.org. We want to thank Legal Help for Veterans. Legal Help for Veterans fights for veterans' disability rights all across the nation. You can reach them at 800-693-4800 or on the web at LegalHelpForVeterans.com. We want to welcome to Veterans Radio today Travis Harmon, Staff Sergeant in the Army National Guard, wrote an interesting story, a remote outpost fighting with the U.S. Army in Afghanistan. But it's more than just his story. It's also a bit of his father's story. Travis, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Well, this is a bit of an unusual story on a number of fronts. You weren't the prototypical recruit the Army was looking for. I think you're a self-described young skater punk at the time. So yep. Tell us a little bit about your background, where you grew up in Pennsylvania, and this decision about joining the Army.
Okay. I grew up in central Pennsylvania around Lanesport, known for the Little League World Series. So there's a lot of farming communities around Lanesport, and I grew up from one in Hughesville. Basically, 9/11 happened. My father had joined in the 80s and got out when I was born. So I always had a family tradition of military service. My grandfather was in, a few of my uncles were in, my older brother joined the Air Force when I was around 10. So I had a lot of family influence in joining. And once 9/11 happened, I was only in eighth grade, but I hoped that one day I would be able to go and fight. And well, my dream came true.
Well, it was not only yours, but talk to us about your relationship with your father, Dean, and how sort of all those family influences led you to say, hey, I'm going to enlist?
Right. So my father joined the Marines in the 80s. And like I said, that he ETS'd out after I was born. He joined the Army, the PA Army National Guard in the early 90s while I was a little kid. So I grew up seeing this military service, and we would watch war movies together, and that, you know, made it even more exciting for me. So as time grew on, I kind of lost interest in it, but my dad would talk to me at random about it. Then once 9/11 happened, he enlisted in the PA National Guard again. And, you know, I saw that as my opportunity to kind of, we never had a really close relationship while I was growing up, so that was kind of my way of earning his acceptance by enlisting with him.
And you then enlisted in the Pennsylvania Army National Guard.
Correct.
It's kind of, that's a whole different process after 9/11. People who are familiar with the Guard pre-9/11, you know, it's a different training tempo, it's a different op tempo. As you got in, this wasn't the National Guard that your dad was in the 90s. Did he talk to you about, hey, this is a whole different op tempo here?
Right. Yeah, so I initially wanted to go active duty Army, and he talked to me and was like, you know, maybe you should go PA Guard for a little bit. It's 1 weekend a month, 2 weeks in the summer. If you like it, you could go active duty. If you don't, then you're stuck with your 1 weekend a month, 2 weeks in the summer. But like you said, the op tempo was completely different. My unit they had deployed to Germany in, I believe it was 04, and then the PA Army Guard 2nd Brigade deployed to Ramadi, Iraq in 06, and my father went with them, and a lot of the guys from my unit went with them as well. So they got back, and while I was in basic training and advanced training, and once I got home, within a week's time, I got orders to go to Afghanistan.
So you did some of your training at Fort Benning and Fort Gordon in Georgia. A whole lot different than Hughesville, Pennsylvania, wasn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Prior to that, I'd never flown. I'd only left the state once to go to New Jersey to the beach. So it was definitely an experience for me.
And was this, did you feel it, like this is part of what my dad wanted me to experience, maybe wanted me to grow up a bit? Because I'm sure everybody who goes through this and goes, I'm not the same kid I was a year ago.
Right. Yeah, so like any son and father, he was trying to give me advice, you know, pull your head out of your butt.
We've all gotten that one, or given it, yeah.
Yeah, so once I did that, he talked to me about joining, and I decided it was probably for the best because I had no, you know, aspirations or anything I wanted to do. So yeah, he talked me into it. And at the time, Band of Brothers had come out on HBO, and my grandfather fought in World War II, so I was very interested in that. And I watched that, and that was kind of my deciding factor of joining. I said, I want to have a band of brothers like that. I want to go into combat. I want to serve my country.
Well, as you say, you go through your training, and then, like a week later, you get orders to go to Afghanistan. How did that impact you, the family, your dad, Dean?
So my parents had divorced when I was 10. But as far as my grandmother, his mother, and that side of the family, they were very worried for both of us. They were happy that he was going with me because he also received orders to deploy. We were in the same battalion. He was in Alpha Company. I was in the headquarters element of the 103rd Armor. And yeah, so the family was worried, but at the same time, my mom came to me and said, I'm glad he's going with you.
It's really an unusual situation where one deploys, even with a family member, a brother, a sister, a mother or a father, really unusual. Did you know anybody else who's doing that type of deployment?
Not so much parent-child relationships, but brother-brother, brother-sister, sister-sister, you know, relationships, sibling relationships. That was more common. I think we came across one other father-son duo that was over there the same time we were.
So this is, 2009 when you're in Afghanistan?
2008.
Tell us about the conditions of fighting in Afghanistan at that point.
So when I first got there, it wasn't too bad. Things were pretty light as far as attacks. Once the old unit ripped out of the outpost we were on, it progressively got worse and worse. The month of April, we were hit pretty much every day, whether it be mortars, attacks, you know, IEDs, what have you. And the interesting part was my father was stationed at Bagram, and he could go into the talk and see what was going on at my outpost while I was getting attacked, you know, what was happening at the time.
So let's expand on that. In the title of the book is Remote Outpost, Fighting with the U.S. Army in Afghanistan. And we're talking to Travis Harmon. Travis, explain to us the outpost you were at and give our veteran radio listeners a little bit of insight of what that was about.
Okay, so the outpost was called Combat Outpost Nigel, and it was in the, I believe it was at the top of the Alashang Valley. It was either the top or the bottom, where the Alashang and Alangar valleys met. We were put there to kind of stop Taliban traffic coming back and forth through Meterlam, which FOB Meterlam was our main base that we operate out of, but 90% of the time we were at the outpost. So generally we would see combat while deployed on the outpost, not so much outside the wire. It started to become pretty heavy where we would get fire outside the wire, but the majority of it was they were trying to overrun us.
And talk about, again, there are a lot of people who are listening, Travis, who don't understand what these outposts were in Afghanistan. This is not a big formal base. There's not a lot of people in it. Give us some sense of the size and the protection that is available in these remote outposts.
Okay. So we had one guard tower initially, and it was called Punisher Base or Punisher Tower. And it oversaw a village that sat right across the road from us. There was a road and then a little bit of a creek, and across that was the village. I can't remember the name of it off the top of my head. So the outpost itself was encircled with three rows of Constantine wire and then claymore mines and trip flares. There were some HESCO barriers that, you know, the barriers filled with rocks and dirt to try and stop bullets and shrapnel, but we had very limited sources up on the outpost. In terms of manpower, we had a platoon of about 20 guys ourselves, and then the Afghan army had about 20 soldiers as well.
During this time when you're in this rotation, that platoon is made up of all Pennsylvania National Guard members?
Yes. Now, the unique part about our platoon, we were an infantry platoon. I joined as a radio operator, and I was assigned to this infantry platoon as their RTO. But the unique thing about our platoon was it was a thrown-together platoon. So we were infantry on paper, but realistically our jobs were, you know, we had cooks, we had mechanics, we had artillery guys, and a handful of infantry guys, but the majority of us were from different, you know, occupational specialties.
And that's was fairly common, I think, as a the war wore on and they kept kind of having to put units together to man up. And so these weren't guys that you necessarily drilled with on a regular basis.
Right. I would say only about two of them were from my actual unit that I drilled with. The rest were from throughout the state.
So now you find yourself in Afghanistan at this remote outpost. What's going on through your mind between that image that you had prior to joining up and the reality that you're now facing?
So it didn't really hit me until about the first weekend, and I was at the main base of FOB Meterlam, and I saw medevac helicopters landing, and they were pulling body bags off of Afghan troops. And they were refueling, rearming the Kiowas that were coming in, the Blackhawks. And, you know, that's when it really sunk in that this is real. This isn't some movie that I've watched growing up. Like, I need to keep my stuff together. I need to keep my head on a swivel, you know. And once the first time outside the wire, I thought I was going to be dead within seconds because I was just not ready for what was to come.
Well, and I think that's the point at which fear, questioning, do I have the stuff to do what needs to be done for my buddies? All that's playing hard on you, isn't it?
Right, yeah. So it's a lot of stress, obviously. You don't want to let your team down. You want to make it home yourself. You want to make sure your buddies make it home with you. And you want to accomplish your mission at the same time. And, you know, as it wore on or went on, I kind of just wrote myself off as dead already. And that took away a lot of the fear for me.
Just mentally saying, hey, this is going to happen, so quit worrying about it?
Exactly, yes.
And the horrific realities of warfare did come to this outpost. Tell us about that.
The warfare at the outpost?
Yes.
So it was pretty, like I said, in the beginning it wasn't so bad. A couple pop shots here and there, maybe an RPG fired at us. But as time passed, it became, we would have to start flying up to the outpost versus taking Humvees because the IEDs were so thick. And there's so many of them planted along our route. We only had about one or two routes we could take by Humvee to get there. So they began to fly us in. Well, when they began to fly us in, they'd be waiting for it to land on the helipad, and they would start shooting at the helicopter. I came back from PASS in Qatar in the beginning of July, and our helicopter couldn't land on the outpost because it was taking fire and the outpost was taking fire. So we had to circle around a couple times, you know, and we did a combat landing and got off just in time to get attacked again.
Tell us a little bit about some of the injuries and casualties associated with the 20 guys and the Afghan troops up there at Outpost Najil.
So we had one of our soldiers, the PA Guard soldiers, take some shrapnel from a Chinese rocket, came in and hit the entry control point that he was manning. Because at this point, we had built up a couple other towers to, you know, basically secure the outpost a little better because it was getting to the point where they were getting pretty close to getting inside the wire. So we decided to push back the perimeter, and in doing so, they started, you know, figuring us out even more. And, you know, it seemed like we had somebody, one of the Terps, or not one of the Terps, but one of the Afghan workers on the post or on the outpost was, you know, an insider working for the Taliban. But, in terms of other casualties, usually the Afghan soldiers took the brunt of it, it seemed. You know, there were multiple casualties there, some killed, some wounded, you know, shot through the legs, shot other places. It was just, they seemed to be bullet magnets in my eyes.
Well, they certainly probably were, from the Taliban's viewpoint, too, that those were the traitors, if you will.
Yes.
As the radio operator at the outpost, again, give the civilian listening here some understanding of what you're doing during these attacks and what the role for the radio operator is.
So if we were on the outpost and we would be attacked, it was my job. I was also a UAV operator, a drone operator, a handheld drone. And it was my job when we started getting attacked to set this drone up, get it in the air to see where the Taliban is. So that was one of my duties as the operator, the radio operator. But generally on a daily basis, I would have to go around and check every radio in the morning, check all the radios before patrol, make sure they had the right, you know, frequencies and whatnot. They're encrypted the right way. And then I would go out on patrol with everyone and take my, you know, my radio with the giant antenna that you see in like the Vietnam movies. And that's what that reminded me of a lot, was Vietnam. Like, obviously I'm too young to have fought in Vietnam, but the landscape and just the patrols on foot reminded me a lot of movies I watched as a kid.
When you're over in Afghanistan, how old are you?
When I'm there, I'm 20.
And how old is your dad about?
He is, at that time, he would be 40.
And he had a different job. You mentioned he was back at Bagram. The whole time you're up at the outpost, is he down at Bagram?
Yeah, so he was the unit movement officer for the battalion. He was the NCO in charge, not the actual officer. But he was in charge of all the helicopter routes for our battalion and our supply movements and troop movements. So, you know, he, I used to joke with him and say, you have a cushy desk job, because he had a desk and he was in a building with air conditioning, and there I was sleeping in a tent with 10 other guys on the side of a mountain.
So. Remember, you're 20 years younger too. So
let me
ask this. Part of your getting involved here was to demonstrate something to your dad, or to create a different relationship with your dad. How did this experience over in Afghanistan, that you both experienced in a different way, ultimately impact the relationship?
If anything, it brought us closer together. Not only were we father and son in a closer relationship, but we were now brothers, that band of brotherhood that I wanted. And I never thought I would find it was my father, but it turned out that I did. And even when we came home, we would swap war stories. And, you know, he was in Iraq, and prior to Afghanistan, I would ask him, how did it compare to my deployment versus your deployment to combat, and, you know, different scenarios that we had been in. And, so it actually brought us really close.
I asked this of a lot of guys, you know, as you know, the military, Travis, is having a hell of a recruiting problem, right? Every branch is. But your dad would have encouraged you to join up and participate, and some of that's family history, some of it's his own experience from being in the Marines. As you reflect back, and when it's time for you to have a son or a daughter, a niece or a nephew come ask Uncle Trav, hey, I'm thinking of joining up. What do you think about that? What's your view on it now?
My thoughts now are, my first thought would be no, please don't. But then that would retract. And, you know, it's a great career if you make it one. You get out of it what you put into it. There are great benefits, you know. It's hard to navigate the VA afterwards, but, you know, once you figure it out or find somebody that can figure it out for you, you know, all the benefits are there for you. It's great in that aspect. What I would say as a word of advice is, be careful what job you pick, or know the job you're going into.
And, you know, I think that's good advice for anything in life, right? Do a little more study, do a little more due diligence, look into things, you know, see what might be useful. If you only spend 2 or 4 or 6 years in, what might be useful afterwards, right? I think that's what you're kind of saying.
Yeah, so in my entire 13 years in the PA Guard, I did 4 different jobs. I was a radio operator, a signal support NCO, a infantryman, and a supply sergeant when I medically retired in 2018. You know, I hated being a supply sergeant, and I loved being an RTO and an infantryman. So, I mean, it's a hard life, and it's hard on your body and your mind, but it's very rewarding.
Well, and you developed that band of brothers that you were looking for. You probably still have a bunch of guys who you're connected with that shared your experiences in a way that nobody else can really relate, I suppose.
Oh, yeah, they're my family, everyone I served with. And like I said, even though my father was on the outpost with me, I still consider him a brother in a sense. And, you know, we have a bond that I feel can never be broken.
Well, we're talking to Travis Harmon. He wrote Remote Outpost, Fighting with the U.S. Army in Afghanistan. It's published by Casemate. Travis, if people want to read the book and learn more, how do they do that?
So there's several ways. You can go to my website, www.travisharmon.com. It's spelled H-A-R-M-A-N. Or you can go to Casemate Publishers and Google or search Remote Outpost. You can just Google my name. You can Google Remote Outpost Travis Harmon. It'll pop up. It's on Amazon, Barnes & Noble. It's available pretty much everywhere.
Well, we really appreciate not only your service, but taking some time to spend with us here on Veterans Radio today. Travis, really a great job, and we're glad that we got a chance to speak.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Military veterans touch everyone's life. I'm guessing right now you're thinking of a veteran, a close friend, relative. Maybe it's you. Even the toughest of us sometimes need help, but don't know where to turn for support. You don't need special training to help a veteran in your life. Even small actions can make a world of difference. If you know a veteran in crisis, please call the Veterans Crisis Line, 800-273-8255, 800-273-8255. A message from the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
We want to welcome to Veterans Radio today. We have a great author to talk to, a staff sergeant from the U.S. Army, 6 years, Michael Cook. Michael, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Hey, thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited.
Well, you have written a book called Life and Death at Abbey Gate. It's really not only about the fall of Afghanistan, but the operation to save Afghanistan, individuals, getting them out through the gate, but also afterwards. So that's really what we're going to talk about. The book is published by Casemate. But let's start with a little background. You're a guy who went to Eastern Michigan University primarily to play hockey, if I understood reading you right, and later on said, "Well, you know what? I'm gonna join the U.S. Army." Kind of an unusual step at that point. Tell us why you did it.
Yeah, I grew up a local guy here in Michigan, growing up in Ann Arbor, and then going to Eastern Michigan. So, you know, hockey was always a big part of my life, as it is with many people in this area, right? So I think I always had that camaraderie, that team feel in my life through my hockey experiences. So then once I graduated college and moved out to California, I kind of lost that. So I was out there for about 5 or 6 years and was just feeling like I really needed something more, like I needed to be a part of a greater organization. And that's really what I think led me to down to the recruiter's office down in Huntington Beach, California. So, went in, talked to the Marine recruiter, talked to the Army recruiter, decided that Army was the, branch that I was more interested in, and, started pursuing, a career with them.
And you talk a little bit about your MOS. You were an engineer, battalion, I think, in construction. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yep, so as an engineer, 12 Whiskey is the designator that I started at. So mainly we did all the Army's construction work, or, you know, security or anything like that, anything that would need to be built or erected, essentially. Engineers do that job. So that's what most of our training consisted around. And then on our deployment to Afghanistan in 2019 and 2020, that's primarily what we were doing, is just building B-huts like barracks or joint operations centers, or, you know, fences for security, whatever the military needed from us, we built it.
Yeah, and while the general population, you know, 99% of the U.S. population doesn't serve, they only think of guys in the Army with, you know, toting a rifle going forward at the pointy end of the spear. But somebody back here is building stuff, cooking meals, doing all the logistics things, taking care of the mechanics on tanks and planes and what have you. So we don't think much about what the construction engineers are doing. So you probably find that pretty frustrating.
Yeah, I mean, everyone in the military has a specialty, right? So there's a million jobs that need to be done. So we just have to make sure that we have guys in the field of operations that are able to complete those tasks when needed.
And it's really through that effort of being an Army engineer that you came to work with a couple of Afghanistan men and got to know them and their families. Set that up a little bit, because it's really the cornerstone of the rest of the story.
Yeah, so when I was in Afghanistan in 2019 and 20, the first part of my deployment was up in a city called Mazar-e Sharif, which is the second largest city in Afghanistan. It's in northern Afghanistan, right on the side of the Hindu Kush Mountains. It's one of the most beautiful places I've ever seen in my whole life. And on that base, we were stationed on a NATO base up there that was ran by the German forces. But on that base, there was two men, two Afghan nationals named Abdul and Mohammed, who I developed a very strong relationship with. Started as a working relationship and turned into a friendship. So they were contractors, and they would essentially supply us with whatever materials that we would need to accomplish our mission. So, you know, going through like the military pipeline of getting materials while you're in Afghanistan can be very time consuming. It could take, you know, multiple weeks or months to get things, but these guys could get them there on like the next day, right? So they were very useful to us. We worked with them every single day, but they also took really good care of us. So they would bring us home-cooked meals from their wives, just because they knew that we were, you know, eating deployment food for a whole year. So like I said, it just really turned into a friendship, and they took great care of us. So when I left Mazar-e Sharif to move on to my next base in Afghanistan, you know, I went in and said goodbye to them, and it was pretty much with the understanding that we were never going to see each other again. Not knowing what was coming down the road, right? Not knowing that the Taliban was going to recapture Afghanistan in summer of 2021. So that's kind of to tee it up how the relationship started with them.
And if I understand it right, these men, Abdul and Muhammad, were brother-in-laws.
Yes, that's correct.
So there's a tight family relationship among them, and you and your team were, some of them were at least brought into that and got that sense, I take it.
Yes, absolutely.
And as time goes on and you're out of Afghanistan, but in 2020, a year later or so, you begin to see what's going to happen. Walk us through kind of what you were watching from the outside and had concerns about.
Yeah, so obviously the Taliban starts encroaching on all of Afghanistan and taking perimeter cities slowly as they march towards Kabul. By this point, all U.S. troops have left Afghanistan. We've made the decision to give up Bagram, probably the most strategic base in all of Asia and the Middle East. And you know, when I look back on it, on my deployment, I can see signs of where things were going wrong. Right, like I was there during the Doha agreement that Trump signed, and I remember the Afghan contractors that were there coming up to me after hearing about it and saying, sir, like, you can't leave, because if you guys leave, we're all going to be slaughtered, is exactly what one of them said. And again, I couldn't see the writing on the wall, but they could see it so clearly. Like, they knew exactly what was going to happen. You know, all of our intelligence assets were saying that the Afghan National Army, the Afghan government that we put in place, is going to be able to hold up after we left for, you know, different periods of time. But most of them said, you know, a year, 5 years, 10 years, infinite. Of course, all of them were wrong, because, you know, as soon as we left, the Taliban took control of the country in, I think, 5 days or something.
It happened so fast, and I would say the American planning was so bad, that these inevitabilities just crashed upon the Afghan nationals that had been working with the U.S. military, didn't it?
Yeah. I mean, in my book, I do a deep dive into, you know, exactly what the failures were at the highest levels, as well as doing a deep dive into what the DOD report says happened versus what, you know, boots on the ground were saying that happened. But there's just so many failures at the highest levels that, you know, we ended up paying for in blood, unfortunately.
Well, in your words, in the book, the withdrawal was a cluster f- and yeah. Everybody knows it was, and unfortunately a lot of Afghan nationals had to live with that cluster. This is everybody from interpreters and translators and drivers, and as Abdul and Muhammad were, folks working on the construction side, materials, logistics. I mean, it's a pretty big group of people, plus their family members, that are sort of left in the lurch, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And you know, those people are, a lot of those people are still there. You know, hundreds of thousands of our allies are still stuck there, and a lot of them are in hiding and on the run from the Taliban. Because if they get caught, there's a very, very strong likelihood that them and their families will be killed. So
there was something created, and we're talking to Michael Cook, author of Life and Death at Abbey Gate. Michael, there was something created called the, Special Immigrant Visas, SIV. I don't know that the general public actually understands what that was supposed to be and how it actually worked.
Yeah. So the Special Immigrant Visa, commonly referred to as the SIV, was a visa that came into existence in the early 2000s, I believe, during the Iraq War. And essentially the visa was supposed to get awarded to our local allies that have worked with us for a certain amount of years. I want to say it's 2 years. So if you're an Iraqi, if you're an Afghan, and you devote your service to the United States and help us against our enemies, we're going to make sure that you're protected should you ever need protecting, and we'll bring you here to the United States under a special immigrant visa. That was the point of it. The program was wildly unsuccessful because they just weren't prepared for the amount of people that were going to be applying. Again, just back to very poor government planning at the highest levels. So due to the influx of applicants and not enough resources to process them, that's, you know, why so many of them got left behind in those summer months of August 2021.
Well, and some of it was just, you know, whoever planned this thing or thought this thing through, you had to prove up that two-year status. You had to prove up how important you were to the American cause. It's not like there was somebody sitting at a desk cranking out paperwork on the computer system, was there?
No, and one of the big problems actually was that a lot of paperwork got lost. So these contractors or these Afghan allies that were working for like a third party, like an American contractor, you know, anytime those contractors would go out of business, all that paperwork would be lost. So now we get stuck with this position where we have these Afghan allies that have devoted their lives to the United States and helping us while we're overseas. And now we don't have any of their paperwork to prove that they're qualified for these visas. So just one of the failures.
Yeah, there's this view that, well, we'll vet people. Well, if there's no paperwork or not a cooperating government, you can't vet them. There's no way to do this. And while this maybe made sense in creating the SIV program, boy, it did not work at all, did it?
No, it was I sat down with Senator Blumenthal after the evacuation and when I was writing my book, and he straight up told me that the system is completely broken and needs to be rebuilt from the ground up.
You talk in the book about what happens at Abbey Gate and also talk about kind of what happens afterwards, the digital Dunkirk I want to talk about. But give us your view on what happened at Abbey Gate there in August of 2021.
Yeah, so I guess there's a few ways to go down that path. But Abbey Gate was essentially an entrance at the Hamid Karzai International Airport, which is in Kabul. It's the civilian airport that's at Kabul. That's the airport that the U.S. government decided to run the evacuation out of. Why we decided to run it out of there, a civilian airport, and not Bagram, a military base that was very well fortified, is a big mystery. But essentially, yeah, Abbey Gate was one of the main gates, where a lot of people ended up escaping, but also was the site of the, suicide bomber, the ISIS-K suicide bomber that ended up killing 13 of our troops.
And it was just utter confusion at the gate. There was no good way to get good people out. While a lot of people evacuated over that week, not nearly enough, which sort of left people like Abdul and Muhammad in this position of getting in touch with old friends like yourself and saying, what can you do for me?
Yep.
How did that develop, and walk us through that couple of days of craziness trying to make something work thousands of miles away?
Yeah, so I had kept in touch with Abdul and Muhammad via WhatsApp after deployment. So, you know, communication kind of slowed a little bit in the years that that passed. But then, you know, July and August of 2021, when the Taliban's coming up on Kabul, is really when our communication picked up heavily. So at that point, both men and their families had fled from Mazar Sharif down to Kabul, because that was the last remaining stronghold of the Afghan National Army and the Afghan government. So the Taliban essentially had them surrounded, as well as all of our allies surrounded. So I get a call from, or a FaceTime from Abdul, and I'll never forget it, because he was holding his little daughter, his baby daughter, and I'm sitting in my kitchen with my mother, and we're FaceTiming, and, you know, I remember my mother had to step off screen because she was just so devastated, because she understood what was about to happen, not only to Abdul and Muhammad, but to their families and their daughters. You know, these daughters are, if they survive, they're going to grow up in a country where they're not allowed to go to school, they're not allowed to work, they're not allowed to leave their homes without a male escort or without their faces covered. I mean, their entire futures are being stripped from them in the moment that we're having this phone conversation. So that was obviously very tough, but Abdul just, you know, essentially asked if I could help him find a way out. And that's really when we started looking into the visas and found the special immigrant visa process. So I reached out to Senator Debbie Stabenow here in Michigan. Her and her team were amazing and very helpful in trying to expedite the process of getting these visas going. Unfortunately, there just wasn't time to get a visa in those short weeks, right? I mean, it can take years. And a lot of people that applied for SIVs still don't have case numbers today, you know, years later. So at that point, we pretty much just knew we needed to make a run for the airport, because even, you know, Debbie Stabenow was set up for failure by the State Department, because the guidance that she was getting and passing on to me was have them shelter at home, wait for the call to get their visas, and then they can proceed to the airport. Well, you know, like I just said, that was never going to happen. So at that point, we knew we had to make a run for the airport. And, you know, they had a pretty disastrous first run at the airport. They ran into a Taliban checkpoint. Muhammad got roughed up real good. They beat him with their rifles. And, when I ended up seeing him a few months later, he was still covered head to toe in bruising. So at that point, we knew we needed to make some deeper connections, and that's really what led to the Digital Dunkirk network of people, essentially the underground group of people that were working online, veterans and civilians alike, just to try to find ways to help these Afghan allies get out of the country.
And this Digital Dunkirk network is working outside, really, the U.S. government process, if I understand it.
It was. I mean, there was a lot of active duty military, and there are a lot of veterans, so a lot of guys and girls that understood the processes that would need to take place, but weren't subjected to the same red tape that you know, a government evacuation was. So we were able to kind of run a little loose outside the lines, which was a lot more effective than, you know, whatever the government was doing.
And you go through in the book, which is an easy, good, informative read, Life and Death at Abbey Gate. You go through various, talk about various individuals who helped along this process, because you were stumbling in the dark. You didn't know how to make this happen. And everybody was learning from everybody else. And a line I wrote down was about the individual courage displayed not only by the Afghan nationals, but also by civilian veterans, active duty military, that individual courage, which was running up against the inept bureaucracy. It had to be frustrating.
Yeah, it was. And like you said, we didn't really know what we were doing. We just knew that it had to happen fast. So I think one line in my book is we were building the airplane mid-flight is essentially what we were trying to do. So we were setting up all these essentially joint operation centers online through all these encrypted messaging apps and just passing information as fast as possible on what was happening at the airport in different ways.
And there's a whole range of people who help out on this. I mean, some sort of big names, maybe bigger influences than others, but a whole range of people are helping on this effort that not only you are engaged with, but you know, tens of thousands of other Afghan nationals are trying to get out.
Yeah. I mean, it took everybody. If you were useful, you were put to work. So whether that meant you were a famous politician or just some veteran like myself that deployed to Afghanistan a couple of years prior, everyone was put to work and did whatever they could to help.
This was a 24/7 exhaustive effort, as you're writing about what you're trying to do and the time zone differences, and I just felt reading it how exhausted you were, but how exhausted Abdul and Muhammad and their family was.
Yeah, and I can't even imagine, because I do remember how tired I was, because, you know, when it's daytime over there, it's nighttime here. So I stayed up every single night for probably a week in a row, and I was exhausted, but I kept putting myself in their shoes. I mean, they're being hunted by a brutal enemy and just trying to escape with their lives, you know, and adding small children into that equation is just terrifying for any American to even think about, but that's the situation that they were in. So I knew, and everyone else working on it knew that there was nothing that was going to stop us. We had to give everything we had.
And it was really some active duty, military, Marines and others who are sort of violating or breaking, bending protocol to make some of this work. And that's an amazing part of the story, that those men and women, active duty men and women, ought to get credit for their humanity and what they're doing right for the country.
Absolutely. I mean, I hate to say that a lot of the Marines were set up for failure at the gates as well, but they really were. I mean, the State Department just really botched this evacuation, and they just weren't the Marines that were at the front lines were not given the proper guidance to execute this evacuation properly. So, yeah, like you said, a lot of times they had to kind of go against policy and just do what they knew was right to save lives. So I was just so proud to share the same uniform as those men and women that stood on the front lines at Abbey Gate.
I do want to say before we run out of time that Abdul and Muhammad and the family was able to get out and relocate. Give us that synopsis quickly.
Yeah, thank you for asking. They're doing great. I won't say exactly where they live, but they live very close to me. I get to see them constantly. I'm going over to their house this weekend for dinner. Kids are doing great and are fluently speaking English, and they're in school and playing soccer, and, you know, the men each have jobs and they're, have their own, apartments. So they're doing fantastic. And we're just so happy to have them here safely.
Well, it's an American success story, and we hope they embrace it, enjoy it. Michael Cook, author of Life and Death at Abbey Gate. If somebody wants to read your very candid, straightforward account of the fall of Afghanistan, the operation to save our allies, where can they find the book?
Yeah, anywhere you buy your books, Amazon, obviously, Barnes & Noble. You can go to my website, which is michaelcook.com. That's M-I-K-A-E-L, cook.com, and you can purchase it there as well.
Well, your service to the country and the Army was really quite noble, but more importantly, the work you did afterwards to honor a commitment made to these Afghan nationals and their families is even more noteworthy. So, Michael, we are very happy to have you here on Veterans Radio.
Yeah, thank you so much. I really enjoyed that conversation.
As stated at the outset, I wanted to talk about Afghanistan today because we're approaching the two-year anniversary of the pullout of Afghanistan. And actually, the U.S. State Department just issued its Afghanistan After Action Review Report 2 years later, and it details the shortcomings that led to, as a quote, the deadly and chaotic U.S. withdrawal from that country after nearly two decades on the ground, close quote. It points out insufficient senior-level consideration of worst-case scenarios and how quickly those might follow. It details findings of the tumultuous final weeks there, and the Biden administration's frenzy withdrawal. It has criticism of the Trump administration before that as well for laying out a plan to withdrawal and giving the enemy an opportunity to get ready for that. But really sharper criticism around the Biden's administration's activities in not anticipating how quickly the government would fall. It's actually much more critical than the White House summary document that was released in April of 2024. This is one of those government reports that you see or hear about with plenty of recommendations that probably nobody will ever follow. The report will go on a shelf somewhere or stored in a server. But it did identify 11 recommendations, and maybe one of the main ones was the need to identify and plan better for worst-case scenarios. And that's probably obvious to all. We want to salute our Afghan veterans, those over a 20-year period who devoted their blood, sweat, and tears, and blood at times, to the mission that was set out for in Afghanistan. I don't know that we can necessarily look at how it ended and view the entire war that way, much like we look back on Vietnam and the chaotic ending at Vietnam, a different view of the entire war and what was accomplished. Similarly, for our Afghanistan veterans, a lot to be proud of. You took the call, you did the work, and we do appreciate it. So we did want to focus today on that particular era of military service, which involved so many people. The Department of Defense says 832,000 American soldiers served in Afghanistan. Now, that's a much smaller number than the approximately 2.7 million American men and women who served in the Republic of Vietnam during the war, and that would be boots on the ground. But it's still a significant portion of our population from an all-volunteer army. That's the other big difference, right? Vietnam had the draft to bring all those folks in. Here, these were all volunteers, both active, reserve, and National Guard, who were called and put to the test. So, again, we appreciate that service and wanted to recognize this two-year anniversary. On Veterans Radio, we can't tell these stories and bring them to you and honor our veterans without the help of our sponsors, including the VA Ann Arbor Healthcare System, nvbdc.org, dedicated to certifying disabled and veteran-owned businesses, the Vietnam Veterans of America Association. I'm talking the national level as a sponsor for us, and we couldn't be more proud. LegalHelpForVeterans.com, which is a veterans disability law firm nationwide, but also our locals, Vietnam Veterans of America Chapter 310 in Ann Arbor, the Charles S. Kettles Chapter, VFW Graff O'Hare, VFW Post 423, American Legion Irwin Prescon Post 46 in Ann Arbor. All of these folks help bring these stories to life. It's pretty amazing when you look back, because we've been on the air for 21 years, that we've been on the air for the entire time of the Afghanistan war. We've told a lot of these stories. I gave reference to just one of them earlier that we did. And if you go back in the archives at veteransradio.org and put in Afghanistan, you'll find a lot of other interesting stories that Dale or myself have had recorded and preserved for history. And that's what we do. We at Veterans Radio tell the stories of our American veterans and keep them for the future. You can continue to help us tell these stories by going to our website and donating. Let's say it's $20 for the 20 plus years we've been on the air, or you can participate in our annual and really only fundraiser, Radio on the River, on September 22nd, 2024 in Ypsilanti. It's a fantastic event. You can go there and find out how you can get tickets, or maybe you want to be a sponsor. We're seeking sponsors, co-sponsors for the program at a $500 level. So great way to keep us on the air and keep involved and with all that we're doing, and we couldn't be more appreciative. So I'm Jim Fossone. I've been your officer of the deck today, bringing you these stories about Afghanistan and highlighting the end of that war. Keep us going here on Veterans Radio. Dale will be back next week. And until next week on Veterans Radio, you are dismissed.